You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 23rd to the 29th of April 2015. My name is John Elms, and today I'm joined by editor John Gill and reporters Holly Else and Chris Parr. Hello to you all. The cost of setting up a MOOC is the lead story in our magazine this week, as a Times Higher Education survey finds that the amounts vary dramatically between institutions. Chris Parr has been poring over that one for us. The European University Association held its annual conference last week, when Holly Else made the trip to Antwerp to report for the THE. She'll be running through what she learnt at the conference shortly. And with 2 weeks to go to the general election, our cover feature this week features a Q&A session with the university spokespeople from Labour, the Conservatives, the Lib Dems and the Greens. John Gill will give you a taste of that. So there's a lot to get through, but we'll begin with Chris and your investigation into the cost of MOOCs. Some startling figures you found, have you?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a fairly straightforward piece, this really. FutureLearn is the currently the only MOOC platform based in the UK of any sort of real note, dealing exclusively in MOOCs. There's lots of great open education resources out there too. But this is an Open Universities platform. Yeah, it sort of goes without saying there's lots of different courses, lots of different lengths, lots of different subjects, but we wanted to get a sense really of just how much it costs on average an institution to develop one of these courses. And so we sent out information requests to the 27 UK universities that partnered with FutureLearn at the time. There's now 30, three have joined since, if anyone's wondering why they're not there. And yeah, we got quite a range of answers. Loughborough University said it had done a couple of courses that had come in at around an average of £10,000 each. The University of Dundee, meanwhile, had allocated £130,000 to its programme. It's produced one MOOC so far. One more is imminent, and they said there could be more in the pipeline too. I think Bristol was £40,000, Edinburgh was £50,000, and then you've got Nottingham where they sort of churned a few out at about £15,000 a pop. So, obviously, as I say, I mean, they're different courses. I mean, the idea here was to get a sort of average figure, so maybe universities that haven't been involved in that sort of thing yet sort of get a sense, and that average figure comes in at about £29,000, £30,000.
One of the things I found interesting about this was that there were a number of universities, just reading the piece, Reading, Exeter, Warwick and King's, which refused to give the information, saying that it would prejudice their commercial interest to do so. I mean, it's interesting, actually, that you have to try and use FOI to get this information in the first place. It's sort of, you'd think that this is the kind of information that universities should be quite willing to give out anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite telling, isn't it? That these institutions are clearly seeing MOOCs very much as, commercially viable, valuable propositions. They obviously think there's some return on the money they're spending.
Yeah.
Do we have any handle on what that return actually is? Or
yeah, we do. I mean, to take your first point, I mean, I didn't want to go down FOI in this. In fact, the first step I took was just to email the universities and say, look, how many MOOCs have you made? And what was your spend on it? I thought that was a reasonable question. And a lot came back, sort of, I think, 10 or so came back and said, here it is. But then I said to those who sort of refused, if you like, I said, well, okay, well, I'm now going to make that an FOI. Can you please, send us that information? And then the institutions you named there said they wouldn't tell us because of commercial interest. So it was, it's a bit of a shame, really, because you would expect them to want to share that. But sorry, just to speak to your second point about the return. We do have a couple of quotes in the piece. I mean, someone at the University of Nottingham tells us that, it's a bit about advertising, it's a bit about experimenting with pedagogy, but they haven't really recruited people to their campus courses. We did a piece about the University of London International Programmes. It did MOOCs on Coursera, the US platform, quite a while ago. I mean, they said they recruited 45 fee-paying students as a direct result of the MOOC that they ran on that platform, which they said was worth about £200,000 to them.
Mm.
So you'd say that was a good investment and a good return. But of course, that is an online provider. I mean, the University of London's international programmes isn't a campus-based institution. So there is a return there.
And one of the recurring complaints or not, observations about MOOCs, and including MOOCs on FutureLearn, is that the sort of students that tend to take them tend to be overwhelmingly people that already have degrees.
Mm.
Perhaps even have postgraduate degrees.
Mm.
I know it varies on, I suppose, depends what the type of course is. Some of these MOOCs are quite different in format and and you know what they're trying to achieve. Some of them do sort of, you know, quite focused CPD and type courses as well, don't they? So
they do. It's interesting you should say that, though, because FutureLearn's actually just banded together several of its courses that are targeted at the other end of the educational spectrum. That's people between school and university. So pre-university, I know the UEA has a course that's sort of about going to university and making the best of it. So that's becoming seemingly a bit of a market here. What it isn't is a course for your typical 18-year-old about to leave home and go to HE. I mean, that
pathway role, that sort of linking school and university, is in some ways that has more obviously commercial implications because you are potentially tapping up student customers in a much more direct way. But
you are, and for that spend, I mean, we did a survey, an analysis last year that showed that there's about 10,700 people sort of register for each course on FutureLearn, and about 1,400 of them complete. So, I mean, that spend might seem high on one hand, but if you looked at how much it would cost to put an advert in a newspaper or a magazine even and sort of see how many students you might reach through that approach, then you sort of get an idea of why maybe institutions are happy to spend.
Can I just ask one last thing? So the most expensive, I know that they say, so let's take the University of Dundee. Dundee's allocated £130,000 to a programme that has so far produced one course, although another one is imminent. What does £130,000 buy you?
Quiet.
Well, I mean, they've worked with that figure includes some external sponsorship as well, so it's not all university money that might have gone elsewhere. But it buys you what we've just discussed. It buys you exposure, it buys you access to international students, people from around the world who might then consider coming to
what's the one course Dundee have there? Do you know what they're specifically what their course
is? What's it on? It's on antibiotic resistance,
right.
I think. So they also get to flex, show off a bit of the areas they might consider themselves quite specialist
in. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's quite a niche area, isn't it?
And does that potentially tap into the idea of commercial interest if they're doing something about, medically related? Presumably their expertise or have some commercial interest in, I don't know.
Well, that wouldn't be the figure, though. I mean, the figure they spent on it wouldn't really fall under that. I just think that universities get a bit edgy when you ask them how much they spend on things.
True. Yeah.
That's absolutely true. Well, Chris's piece is on pages 6 and 7, well worth the read, just to see the discrepancy between universities about what they spend on these courses. Holly, fresh from your trip to Belgium, you've heard some interesting announcements from the European University Association's new Commissioner for Research, Science and Innovation, I believe. What's he been saying to you?
Yeah, so this is Carl Esmeridas, who is the new Commissioner for Science and Innovation at the European Commission. He was at the European Universities Association's annual conference, where one of the main topics of debate was this issue about the funding being diverted from Horizon 2020 into the head of the Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker's strategic investment plan. Now, lots of scientific organisations and universities are quite opposed to this move. It's sort of a cut of about 3% of Horizon 2020's budget in order to fund this new plan, which is unclear whether universities will actually be able to access. So it was obviously something that the UEA has spoken out on before, so Carlos was there really to go through his reasons why he thinks this is a good idea, not really things we hadn't heard before. So he says this money, if it's in this strategic investment fund, can actually fund more science in the long run because it's part of a loan scheme that will leverage private funding. So he's saying you can get more bang for your buck. But he also talked, I think for the first time, about what other sorts of things he's interested in doing while he is the commissioner. He talked about a new visa scheme that he's hoping to introduce, which will enable researchers from outside the EU stay in the EU a bit longer after they finish their work. And he also put gender issues at the top of his agenda too. Talked about how the commission has a role to play in this imbalance of female senior researchers that we're seeing in universities across the continent.
I think it's interesting, we had this very large delegation of vice-chancellors from UK universities that were over in Brussels last week as well, which I think sort of ties into the same issue really about this cut of about a couple of billion pounds, isn't it, to the research budget. And I think elsewhere in the magazine this week actually we have a sort of longer analysis piece where we interview, among others, Sergej Borisovic at Cambridge, who talks about the importance to UK universities of EU research funding. I think they do win a disproportionately large chunk of that cash, don't they? And the point is made in that as the sort of levels of competition for research funding, you know, within national system really ramps up, you know, EU funding is becoming increasingly vital to, you know, research efforts in countries like the UK. So do you think that this budget cut could have a very significant impact on sort of UK science, UK research? Is that the worry?
I think it could definitely have an impact. I mean, some universities are more successful in securing this funding than others. And actually, the specific pot of money that's most in jeopardy here is for the European Research Council, which funds mainly fundamental science. So that's quite an important area, really, for universities to be losing funding from.
When
the agenda is very much pushing towards more applied research from other funders. Not just the EU.
One of the points that's made is that by Paul Boyle, actually, who's Vice Chancellor of Leicester, is that the success rates for the ERC grants are currently stand at 12%, which is already much lower than for any of the UK Research Council. So if that gets pushed down even further, there probably will come a point at which the time and effort in applying for these things, you know, the rate of return starts to become perhaps untenable.
Yeah, it's not uncommon even now for academics to not bother to apply for ERC grants because their chances of success are so slim.
Yeah, that's an important issue.
You have in your piece a comment from the president of the EUA, Maria Helena Nazare. Forgive the pronunciation if we got that wrong. And she said that I think 3/4 of universities won't have access to this.
Yeah, so this is across Europe, and there's restrictions in many countries about what funding universities can take. And essentially, this new scheme that we are hearing about, so the Strategic Investment Scheme, it's not solely based on loans, but a large portion of it is loans based on private funding or leverage from public funding. And she's saying that 3/4 of universities in Europe just frankly aren't allowed to borrow money from private sources, so wouldn't even be able to access this fund, which Maria Dash is saying will be so great for science in Europe.
But his point was that European universities should be more vocal on the subject. I mean, it's all very well, you know.
Well, yes, you could say they've been pretty vocal already. But he has been listening to them. This is what he continually tells us every time he gets up and talks about this. I'm listening to your concerns. And it does very much sound like he's trying to put these across to, obviously, the powers that be. But exactly how successful he can be in changing their mind, or whether he even wants to, is another issue, I think.
Absolutely. And Holly's piece is on page 10 in the magazine, and Jack's in-depth look at the Horizon 2020 funding cuts is on page 20 and 21. We are 2 weeks away from the general election, and you might have heard some, you know, in the press some stuff about this. It's quite a popular topic at the moment. THE has been doing their bit with this Q&A feature. John, you're going to give us a bit of a taster about what our expert panel have been asking them, and also what can the readers expect in THE's coverage of the 2015 election?
Well, and we've already done an awful, you know, we had the election hustings a month or so ago, which was a very interesting, lively affair in Westminster, which was great, and that sort of kicked off the discussion about higher education from the different parties. On that night, we had representatives from Labour, the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats up on stage, and they answered various questions from the audience. This time we've got 4 representatives. We have Liam Byrne for Labour, Greg Clark for the Conservatives, Sal Brinton for the Liberal Democrats, and Dave Kokoza, who is the Greens higher education spokesman and also a current student. And what we've done is ask, rather than put questions ourselves, we've asked a dozen very well-respected experts and within different fields in higher education, most of whom are also regular THE contributors, to form a special Times Higher election panel and put questions to the different candidates. And I think it works really well because there's a lot of value actually in reading the questions that these academics and leaders and so on want to ask, as well as the responses from the different parties. And
it was described, I should say, on Twitter by Smita Jamdar, an education lawyer, as one of the most intimidating panels you've ever witnessed. We tweeted a picture of it before publication, and it's quite a
It's good.
A formidable list, yeah.
But it covers the whole range of topics that you would expect, people working in universities to care about, everything from sort of, the very nature of the funding system. David Bell, for example, the Vice Chancellor of Reading, asks, are students customers, and if not, what are they? That's the sort of tenor of some of the questions. But what comes through, I think, is that, we do have these actually quite entrenched divergent positions from the different parties. I think often within an election campaign you can't really expect the minutiae of higher education policy to be front and foremost. It's just not going to happen.
What? No, surely not.
However, clearly tuition fees has been a big issue both in the last election and this one. But what we're trying to do is really get beyond fees and funding, and there's a bit of that, but actually all the other things that really matter to our universities, and tease out some of the answers to those big questions too. So it's a fascinating piece. I'm not going to trawl through it. There's 20 questions there and long responses from all four candidates throughout. So well worth a read if you're yet to make your mind up about who to vote for on the 7th of May, or indeed if you've already decided to have a look and see whether the candidates are promising what you think they are for higher education.
Absolutely. And in the main, the representatives from the parties weren't too evasive. It's quite difficult sometimes to be evasive on paper, but you can still do it.
Well, read the piece and make up your own mind.
Absolutely. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this in this week's issue review. Of course, we value our readers' input. And so if you'd like to comment on any of the content on this week's edition, you can find us on all manners of social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and of course our website.
And write us a letter.
Write us letters. Yes, we have.
It comes and goes, but I think newspaper letters pages are great forums for debate, and it would be a shame if all the commentary was on social media and not in the slightly longer form of a letters page. There's nothing like a to and fro on an issue in the newspaper letters page. So do make use of it.
Absolutely, and if you want to.
I've got it here.
Oh, you've got it here. Thank you.
Yeah, the.letters@tesglobal.com.
We should probably have had that in my memory already.
Send it by post.
Snail mail still works and we still get letters. Yeah, absolutely. Well, anyway, if you do want to do that, please do feel free. And until then, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.